Hi, I'm Sidney Lumet. I directed Network. And one of the regrets of my life is that Paddy Chayefsky, who wrote this, is not alive now, because nobody had a more perfect sense of the ridiculousness of the way we live.
In 1969, however, his fortunes began to decline.
Whether it was when we made this movie or the way we would be living now.
He was left a childless widower with an 8 rating and a 12 share. It became
one of the things you're going to find about Network, about all of the television work in here, language, as well as the way it's visually attacked, is that it's absolutely authentic. Paddy and I both came from live television. In fact, I think I did Paddy's first script on a half-hour melodrama I used to do in the early 50s called Danger. And Paddy submitted a script based on a Nelson Algren short story that was so beautifully written. I still remember it. At any rate, he went on to be doing some of the most distinguished work in television, including a 2-hour show that he did for Fred Coe called Marty, which is, I believe, the first television drama that was bought for movies, and made a wildly successful movie. I think it won an Academy Award, and that was the beginning of Paddy's illustrious career in the theater and in motion pictures.
And the cabbie turns around and he says, don't do it, buddy.
One of the things I'd like to talk to you about as this picture progresses. The picture is about corruption, really. Everybody gets corrupted. Except for the madman who, as you will see, stays absolutely pure. And one of the ways that we reinforce that is that in the lighting, in the camera work, you'll see that it starts just about naturalistically. That scene that you just saw out on 6th Avenue and here in the bar. The least amount of artificial light possible and highly directional, coming only from where the natural light was coming from. And yet, as the movie goes on, you'll see by the time we reach the last scene looks like a Ford commercial. That's the way it's lit. So that even the camera got corrupted as the movie went on.
Suicides, assassinations, bad bombers, mafia hitmen, automobile smashes.
You've got here two of the best actors that have ever been in movies. Bill Holden, you probably know from so many other movies. This is maybe his finest job. There are a couple of others. Stalag 17 was brilliant. And yet he always was, believe it or not, shy about acting. He was a very private man. People did not know much about him. In all of his publicity, there was practically no personal revelation at all. When he wasn't working, he went to Africa, to Kenya, where he at first had a small personal house, and then it slowly grew and grew until it was one of the best resorts in Africa. But he always kept his privacy there as well.
10 seconds on the shooting itself.
The whole thing is 125.
You're seeing here an absolutely accurate portrayal of the assembly getting ready for an evening's news broadcast with a devotion of how many minutes we're going to do for this, how many seconds we're going to devote to that. And again, as I say, totally accurate.
Gun control, Paddy Hurst affidavit, Gorillas in Chad, OPEC, Indiana.
One of the things that happened, United Artists financed and distributed the movie. And one of the few notes that they gave Paddy, they gave him two sets of notes. And one of them was, nobody's going to understand this language. A HUD rating, all of the jargon that comes into the live television world as brought there by the advertising agencies. And Patty said something to the head of United Artists then that was... It's something that's always stayed with me. I've never forgotten it because it had such meaning. He said, they may not understand what the individual technical references are, but they will know that it's accurate and that it's real. And he was absolutely right. Nobody ever questioned it, and the sense of reality that it gave it all was irreplaceable. You're looking at a control room now, a television control room for live broadcasting. And this is something that I, of course, had so much experience with. The kidding around, the not paying attention, the eating, the relaxed atmosphere of it could only belong to something that you could say to each other, well, don't worry about it. We've got another one tomorrow, or we've got another one next week. It was one of the joys of live television. For those of you, by the way, who don't know about live television, whether in drama or newscasts, it is being transmitted at the moment that it's actually being spoken or performed. And this was a fashion up until, I would think the late 50s, early 60s, when they began recording television instead of putting it on tape or film.
Howard just said he was going to blow his brains out next Tuesday.
What are you talking about?
Didn't you hear him? He just said... Howard just said he was going to kill himself next Tuesday.
What do you mean Howard just said he was going to kill himself next Tuesday?
Of course, the joke here is that nobody was paying any attention to what the man was saying.
Next Tuesday, I'm going to shoot myself.
What the hell's going on?
I don't know. He just said he was going to blow his brains out.
What the fuck's going on, Howard?
They want to know what the fuck is going on, Howard.
I can't hear you.
Turn the studio mic on.
We're back on in 11 seconds.
10 seconds.
Pretty too.
Howard, what the hell are you doing? Have you flipped or what?
I think we better get him off.
Get him off.
What's the matter with you, fellas? Get your fucking off.
You know, people always used to say that Network got a wonderful reception. I've forgotten how many nominations it got, but they were an awful lot. And one of the things that they always said is, oh, what a brilliant satire. Well, as far as Patty and I were concerned, it wasn't a satire at all. It was sheer reportage. And in fact, everything except the very ending of the movie has already happened on TV. Patty was capable of seeing the future, as we can see not only in this movie, but in another very brilliant movie that he wrote called Hospital, including the scene in Hospital where a man died on a gurney and went up and down the elevator for 2 days before anybody realized it. That was followed by that actually happening about 2 months after the picture opened.
Good evening. Howard Beale, one of television...
They're all going to make it their lead story.
Howard Beale interrupted his network news program tonight to announce that he was going to kill himself.
An unusual thing happened at one of our sister networks, UBS, this evening.
How are we handling it?
One of the surprises of the movie is Bob Duvall, because he would never normally be cast in a part like this. And I felt it was terribly important that we get it, not a New Yorker, not a seemingly sophisticated man, that we get somebody who really seems as if they come from the heartland, because so many people in television really do.
You better have some answers for some of those nuts that always come to stock.
Mr. Beale has been under great professional and personal strain.
I've got some goddamn surprises for you, too, Schumacher. I've had enough to hear with your credit division and its annual $33 million deficit.
You keep your hands off my news division, Frank. We're responsible to corporate level, not you.
We'll goddamn well see about that.
All right, take it easy. Right now, how do we get Beale out of here? I understand there are at least 100 reporters and camera crews in the lobby.
The whole picture was so anticipatory of everything that's happened now, because, as you'll see, by the end of the movie, the news has been expanded to an hour, but it's a total entertainment show. It's, as you'll see, it's got soothsayers on it, it's got jokes on it. The news has become total entertainment, which is, God knows, something that's happening today.
switch him to projection room 7.
Hawk will come in here a minute.
I'm sorry, Bill. This field business.
It's all right. Diana asked if she could sit in on this.
Fine. How's it going?
There is a heavenly Faye Dunaway. Now, Faye, she's enormously concerned with the way her clothes look, but it's all in the service of the part. It's all in the service of the script. It's all in the service of what we are all working on.
That the most pressing political necessity today is the consolidation of the revolutionary, radical, and democratic movements into a united front.
Harry, Howard Beale left my house about 20 minutes ago. Did he come in yet?
I remember the first time I met her. This is absolutely true. She was living on Central Park West. I went up to see her. And as I walked across the room to her, I said, Faye, I know what your first question's going to be. And she said, what? And you're going to say to me, where's her vulnerability? And I just want to start the meeting off by telling you that, number one, she has none. She has no vulnerability. She's a television baby. She's brought up on television. And television is her whole life. And if you try to sneak any sensitivity in on me, I'll take it out in the cutting room. And she paused for about a second. Then started to smile, and off we went, going to work.
Well, that's the great Ahmed Khan.
Some of this is based on actual news events that were prevalent at the time. The bank robbery you're about to see. Kidnapping and recruitment by a revolutionary gang. And Patty, of course, picked up on that, as well as a million other items that were real news at the time for use in the movie.
Yeah.
Max, I've got Howard on the other line.
All right, put him on.
Howard, I've got Max on 4, which is good.
Yeah. Listen, Max, I'd like another shot.
Oh, come on, Howard.
I don't mean the whole show.
I just like to come on.
Here's Peter Finch, one of the best actors, stage, screen, what have you. Peter was Australian and went to England for a theater career. He was so eager to play this part. I felt that it was, again, critical to have an American. And he said, please. He was down in, he lived in the Caribbean. I don't remember where. He was down there and called me and said, do me a favor. Send me today's copy of the New York Times, and I'll have it back to you in 3 days. And what happened was that he sat down and read the New York Times practically from cover to cover to show that he could do American speech. Since there had never been any doubt about his acting talent, we, of course, were thrilled at that, and he got hired for the part and won the Academy Award. Faye won the Academy Award. Bill was nominated for the Academy Award. One of the nice things about the picture was I think there were 5 acting nominations for the movie. Peter and Bill were running against each other for Best Actor. Faye won for Best Actress. And Beatrice Strait, who you'll see in a little while, she won for Best Supporting Actor. And Ned Beatty was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Hobgoblin radicals call the Ecumenical Liberation Army who go around taking home movies of themselves, robbing banks.
As you'll see, in terms of the selflessness of Faye,
hijacking 747s,
she says the most outrageous things, does the most outrageous things, never tries for sympathy for a minute, plays the purity of a hellion who's going to get her own way or kill on the way.
Why not? They've got Strike Force, Task Force, SWAT. Why not Che Guevara and his own little mod squad? Look, I sent you all a concept analysis report yesterday. Did any of you read it?
One of the ways in which the picture was so prescient was that that what she's talking about here, if you think about it, is really the birth of everything we're living through today, something called reality television. That I can't abide. I've never sat through one of the programs. It seems to me they're all based on the humiliation of the people who participate in them. But here it is. Patty's laying it out. And we're talking about a picture, I believe it was 1976, wasn't it? I'm terrible on years, but mid-70s, 30 years ago.
Butch Boston, the people. But when I took over this department, it had the worst programming record in television history. This network hasn't one show in the top 20. This network is...
One of the things about Faye, because so much of the... In fact, the whole picture was shot on location. There was no studio at all. And lighting is so much more difficult on location because you can't always get the lamps where you want to get them. And again, this actress never checked the lighting, never wondered where there's the key light coming from. She would just come onto the set, having been fully rehearsed, and did this superb, superb job.
But the business of management is management. And at the time CCA took...
The cameraman was a wonderful cameraman by the name of Owen Roizman, who subsequently went out to Hollywood. All of this, as you can see, was done in New York. And where he, I believe, won at least two more Academy Awards. I know Sidney Pollack used him very heavily. First-rate work. And as you see, not beautifying anything yet, you'll see slowly, I'll point out where the light starts to change, how he starts corrupting everything. Does it so slowly and so subtly that you never see it happening.
But to our minds, this philosophy is a wanton fiscal affront to be resolutely resisted. The new plan calls for local news to be transferred to owned stations divisions. News radio would be transferred to the UBS radio division, and in effect, the news division would be reduced from an independent division to a department accountable...
On the right, slightly out of focus, you see a wonderful actor by the name of Wesley Addy, who is perfect casting as a network executive.
Not the time. Why wasn't I told about this? Why was I led up onto that podium and publicly humiliated in front of the stockholders? Now, goddammit, I spoke to John Wheeler this morning, and he assured me that the news division was safe. Now, if you're trying to get me to resign, that's one hell of a way to do it.
We'll talk about this tomorrow at our regular morning meeting.
Everything was shot here in New York, all on location, except this television studio, both the control room and the stage, and the bigger stage that you'll see later on, was shot in Canada. The reason we did it up in Canada was not for the reasons that you see it today, which is cheaper. It wasn't particularly cheaper. But it was extremely difficult to get hold of a live television facility in America.
Good evening. Today is Wednesday, September the 24th.
The sheer physical space was not available. The closest we came was Channel 5 in New York. Thought they might be able to give it to us for a little while, for 3 days or 4 days. But I actually needed 2 weeks. As you'll see, there's a tremendous amount of television studio stuff in the picture, both control room and later on down in the studio itself when the Howard Beale show becomes the big thing.
Just went out of bullshit.
Yeah. Look, Mr. Schumacher's right here. Do you want to talk to him?
So we were able to rent a facility in Canada for a whole two-week period, and we went up there to shoot all the television footage.
Through all this pointless pain, humiliation, and decay, so there better be someone somewhere who does know. That's the god bullshit.
He's saying that life is bullshit, and it is. So what are you screaming about?
Man is a noble creature that can order his own world.
We shot all of the shows as if they were live shows. They were not individual setups. If I needed more than one camera, I did it with more than one camera. Again, later on, you'll see those sequences. But in all of this, Peter was actually on the set being photographed by a television camera, which was being sent into the control room, and all of it done at the moment. There was a camera, a movie camera, photographing the television camera, photographing Peter, going on at the same time that this was being fed into the control room, to keep that feeling of it being a live show going. All of these interiors were done at the MGM building on 55th Street and 6th Avenue. Almost all of the offices were done there, and the executive dining rooms, etc., etc.
Max?
That's one of the reasons that you love to go on location, is that you cannot fake that look outside. Because the usual thing of putting a backdrop, even if it's a night backdrop, they just don't look like this. You don't get that blackness, that feeling of real night. And it's one of the joys of shooting in New York on location.
It doesn't seem to be anything more to say.
I have something to say. I want to know why that whole debasement of the news division announced that the stockholders' meeting...
Now, already the tiniest bit of slightly more, well, I don't know what you'd call it, in a way, dramatic lighting or romantic lighting. But it's starting to move away from the naturalistic look of everything that's happened so far.
You or some conglomerate called CCA. I mean, you're president of the systems group, and Hackett's nothing but a hatchet man for CCA. Nelson here, president of a network, and he hasn't a damn thing to say about anything anymore.
I told you at the stockholders' meeting, Max, that we would...
I don't know whether Bill had ever done a picture which had that much resonance in terms of the way we were living today. Other than Stalag 17, which for all of its comedy, still had a hell of a lot to say.
And satisfied.
And I think he loved it. One of the joys, again, of having a writer like Chayefsky is that when you send a script to an actor, you don't expect, nor do you get, a rejection. Everybody, except for the Peter Finch character, where I tried some other actors first, everybody was our first choice.
Bob McDonough will take over the news division until we can sort all this out. I'd like to see Mr. Beale now.
I'm looking for him, Ed.
I don't know where he is.
Well, every day, 5 days a week, for 15 years, I've been sitting behind that desk.
The hardest thing to achieve in the movie, especially for me, because I'm not naturally a good comic director, the hardest thing to achieve was the balance between the comedy and the drama. How to make the jokes and yet let you know that something more serious was going on. So that what finally happens doesn't, and I don't want to tip it in case you haven't seen it, but that what finally happens doesn't come out of left field. To know that the drama is coming right out of the comedy. In that sense, Patty was very much like George Bernard Shaw. He had something to tell you, but he was going to sugarcoat it with laughter to get you to enjoy it so you weren't just being fed a lecture.
The running characters are a crusty but benign ex-Supreme Court justice, presumably Oliver Wendell Holmes by way of Dr. Zorba. There is a beautiful girl graduate student and the local district attorney who is brilliant and sometimes cuts corners.
Next one.
One of the things that Patty did, of course, knowing the field so well, having written for so much of it, is that he knew every television, dramatic, drama cliche, and used every one of them in the discussions of television. He left nothing out.
The Arabs have decided to jack up the price of oil another 20%. The CIA has been caught opening Senator Humphrey's mail. There's a civil war in Angola, another one in Beirut.
Now notice almost every one of those lines. That situation is happening exactly the same today, including even Beirut.
Howard Beale. There's also a two-column story on page one of the Times. Helen, call Mr. Hackett's office. See if he can give me a few minutes this morning.
One of the things that happened when the picture came out, since Patty and I had both been brought up in television, was there were a couple of people who said, boy, the two of you, you made your living off television all these years, and then look how you turned on it. Look how vicious you got about it. Well, Patty and I never felt that. I always maintained, and Patty agreed with this too, that we never left television. It left us. When it stopped being live, when drama became canned, either on tape or on film, it lost everything it had to offer. The value of being live was that it was like the theater, that you got a kind of excitement and continuity and performance that was impossible to get any other way. Even though camera work might not have been as slick, might have been a little cruder in the lighting, but you got in live television something closer to the theater than, even though it's being photographed, than a movie. And when that went, we felt we'd lost the best part of it. And the canning of it, by canning I mean the fact that it was put on film, the fact that it was put on tape, what that was doing was all for financial reasons. It was all for making more money. Well, there's nothing wrong with making more money if you're not destroying the goose that's laying the golden egg. And we both felt that the goose was being destroyed.
Yes. Tell him I'll be a few minutes.
So this kind of vicious comedy that you see about television and that you see in Faye's character, we had no hesitancy about. We didn't want to soften it, make it more delicate. There she goes. And here comes the first corruption. And we were rather proud of it. Faye's character is not corrupt, you see. Faye's character is that from the minute she was born.
And you know I'm going to be eyeball to eyeball with Mr. Ruddy on this. If I'm going to the mat with Ruddy, I want to make sure of some of my ground. I'm the one whose ass is going on the line. I'll get back to you, Diana.
I don't believe this. I don't believe the top brass of a national television network is sitting around their Caesar salad.
Top brass of a bankrupt national television network with projected...
One of the things that happens, of course, when anything is successful, whether it's Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany or what have you, when Truman Capote's book came out, every girl who had not been born in New York, who had a little bit of money, said, oh, Holly Golightly is based on me. Well, as soon as the picture's a hit, everybody says, oh, that character was based on me. And what was very funny was, despite the fact that Faye's character is really the heavy in the movie, if there is a heavy, the number of people who laid claim to being the real person that Patty drew on for the portrayal was amazing. And that included, by the way, that went on to the Holden character, to the Duval character, to the Peter Finch character. As soon as it's successful, there are an awful lot of authors.
It's duly recorded. You can always resign tomorrow. Now look, what in substance are we proposing? Merely to add editorial comment to our network news show. Brinkley, Severide, Reasoner all have their comments. Now Howard Beale will have his. I think we ought to...
The kind of power lunch of this in their own dining room. What's interesting is, very subtly, you may have seen at the very beginning, and well, there you see it now, is when the chief wants to talk privately, he talks privately, no one else comes into that lunchroom.
Oh, I don't know. I may teach, I may write.
Holden did not have any theater background. And so he had heard that I rehearsed, but he had never really done it before. And when I rehearsed, it's not just going over the script and talking about character and so on. I actually stage it, like in the theater. And he had, he said, one of the best times of his life. Because all of a sudden he was, he felt like a real actor. And he hadn't been treated that way in the early part of his career.
He's the kid I think you once sent out to interview Cleveland Amory on Vivisection.
That's it.
What's so funny?
So I jump out of bed in my pajamas, I grab my raincoat, I run downstairs, I run out in the street.
You know, very often when actors are doing movies, they have no time with each other. They meet on the set, they do their scene. I remember Henry Fonda once telling me that he had gone to Italy to do a Sergio Leone movie. And he came on the set, and Sergio said, Hank, this is Claudia Cardinale. Claudia, this is Henry Fonda. And he took off his bathrobe and got into bed, and they played a love scene on the first day of shooting.
And he wants Howard to go back on and do his Angry Man thing.
And the sense of pleasure that you can get from contact with the people you're going to be working with over a long period of time is reinforced completely by the rehearsal time.
Sounds pretty good.
Who's this they?
Hackett. Cheney was there. The legal affairs guy. Oh, and that girl from programming. Christensen. What's she got to do with this?
You're kidding, aren't you?
I'm not kidding. I told him, I said, look, we're running a news department down here, not a circus.
One of the things that's so extraordinary about Holden is that whatever fear he had, it was, again, on a very private level. I never saw any until one scene that I'll tell you about and what the solution was. But he was fearless in terms of trying something new, even though by this time, I don't know whether he had done 50 pictures, 60 pictures, perfectly willing to find a new way to work.
Denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
Then grab it.
He had this total respect for Peter Finch, as happens so often with movie actors when they go to work with theater actors, because Peter had a big career in the London theater.
Thank you.
Nelson Cheney tells me Beale may actually go in the air this evening.
As far as I know, Howard's going to do it. You going to sit still for this, Ed?
Yes.
Working on location is always tougher than when you're working in a studio, because in a studio you can move the walls. You've got all the height you want. You can place the lamps wherever you want to. But in location, you're obviously restricted. The trick of it is to just use the space, not fight it. And stage the scene so that you're getting the maximum out of the location, rather than giving in to the problems.
I have to assume that Hackett would...
For instance, I don't know whether you've noticed so far, but in almost every scene in an office, one of the characters is always staged by the window so that there's a sense of space, a sense of air in the room, even though, as in this instance, what you're looking at now, the shots are rather tight.
Of course, Ed. Thank you, Max.
This has been the UBS Evening News.
But even these kinds of interiors is so... difficult, because to get that kind of lighting on Holden at a time like this, in a real room, not easy. And now, from the camera point of view, now we start moving really into a much more stylized form. You'll see in this scene, which is the first scene with some real sex about it, in which there's a real attraction between the Dunaway character and the Holden character. The lighting is, for the first time, genuinely romantic, genuinely unnatural. By unnatural, obviously you can't spot it, because we're better than that. We work subtly.
And here I am.
But it's just done very carefully to emphasize the romantic nature of the scene itself. It's, by the way, technically horrendously difficult, because as you look around the room, you'll see that even on the walls that aren't window walls, as you'll see when we get to the end of the scene. When they take the exit, one wall is also glass, leading to the showing to the outside where the secretary's pool is. Now, of course, as soon as you got glass, you're going to have reflections. You're going to have reflections of the camera. You're going to have reflections of the light. You've just got to work so carefully to be able to solve it. And there you go. That's what I mean. And so three of the four walls are glass. And yet, Owen was able to hide the lights, use the lights in such a way that there was no loss of romanticism.
Well, you're not serious, are you?
Oh, I'm serious. The fact is, I could make your Beale show the highest-rated news show in television if you'd let me have a crack at it.
And, of course, as far as the Dunaway character goes, she's romantic, she's flirting, but it's all about work. Like everything in her life. And you'll see as we get to the end of the scene, and the two of them are at the doorway, I'll shut up for that, because it's two of the sweetest and funniest and sexiest lines that there are in the script. And yet it's all about work.
Scandal, brutal crime, sports, children with incurable disease and lost puppies. So I don't think I'll listen to any protestations of high standards of journalism.
And if you heard that summation that she made of what a modern news program is like when she said there's a minute and a half of hard news, it's absolutely true and maybe even truer today than it was. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but almost every local news show tries to wind up with an upbeat story at the end, an upbeat piece of news. Little Joey has been found. He didn't get, he didn't fall into the sewer. It's, as corrupt as anything I've ever seen. It was true then, and it's truer now.
It was a fluke. It didn't work. So tomorrow, Howard goes back to the old format, and all of this gutter depravity comes to an end.
That lovely little moment of regret there, because she realizes she's going to have to get in a position to fire him, and she's got a crush on him already.
7:30, and then came all the way down here just to pitch a couple of loony showbiz ideas, when you knew goddamn well I'd laugh you right out of the office. I don't get it.
Here comes the moment when Holden crosses up to her that I was talking about before.
My little visit here tonight was a gesture made out of your stature in the industry. And because I personally admired you since I was a kid majoring in speech at the University of Missouri. But sooner or later, and with or without you, I'm going to take over your network news show, and I think...
One of the things about the Dunaway character is also, there's nothing duplicitous about her. She's absolutely upfront and honest all the time.
University of Missouri.
I was in the audience. I had a terrible schoolgirl crush on you for a couple of months.
If we could get back for a moment to that gypsy who predicted all that about emotional involvements in middle-aged men. What are you doing for dinner tonight?
I can't make it tonight, love. Call me tomorrow.
She's all heart.
You have a favorite restaurant?
I eat anything.
Son of a bitch, I get a feeling I'm being made.
You are.
Well, I've got to warn you, I don't do anything on my first date.
We'll see.
One of the advantages of rehearsal is that you really iron out all of the problems before you get on camera. I don't think I ever went more than, I think I might have been take two. I just don't work that many takes. Not necessary if you've really prepared it well. This, of course, for those of you who don't know New York, is Elaine's restaurant. Elaine's a great friend of mine and a terrific, runs a good bar, by God. And I think she only lets friends of hers shoot there. I mean, she lets Woody Allen shoot there. She let me shoot there.
When I had an affair with my adults, they told me
I was the worst lady you'd ever had.
She doesn't usually let the place out. And you have to come in on a Monday because that's her... It's not even her slow day. It's just... It's her slower day. It's her slowest day.
Quickly, consummate, prematurely. And I can't wait to get my clothes back on and get out of that bedroom.
There she goes again. She just has no duplicity about her. Everything's up front. This is what I am. Take it or leave it. She doesn't try to seduce anything. She just tells you the truth, gives you a choice. It's what makes her kind of, in a terrible way, it makes her noble. It's also, by the way, absolutely accurate in terms of the way many of these people function. I remember, again, in my early television days, in live television days, we'd always have a member of the advertising agency, a representative, in the control room, watching rehearsal, giving us his notes. It was always a man, by the way. And watching the most important thing, which was how the commercials were done and photographed. And I remember the guy who was the agency rep, he was called, on the show we were doing. And it was a dumb job, and a job that could just make you feel, well, let's put it this way. You wouldn't wind up with a hell of a lot of self-respect doing it for a long period of time.
Is your wife in town?
And I said to him one day, how long have you been doing this? And he said, about 14 years now. And I said, and you're having a good time. All this is all right with you. I mean, you don't, you go to sleep well and easily. No problems. And he said, look, it's very simple, and I made the adjustment when I first came into the agency. I'm a whore. I admit it. What he was saying was, if he's honest about it, that takes the curse off all of it. He wasn't trying to kid himself. The fact that it was just as much, that it was just as reprehensible, what he was doing, never occurred to him.
Why me?
He told you the truth. I'm a whore, and
said, why me?
What's so terrible about it? The honesty of the admission wiped out what he was at, the fact that he was a whore.
Howard in his office. Oh, Harry. I'm killing this whole screwball angry prophet thing.
One of the things that Patty's scripts always demand, the actors and the director, are these fine lines between his comedy, his seriousness, but also his madness. Patty's scripts almost always go so far past reality in terms of anyone's honest behavior. I mean, by honest, I mean normal behavior. As far as Patty's people go, they're all honest. But Peter's character in this slips into what one thinks of as madness, but does it so gradually and so logically, like this speech that he's doing right now, that you absolutely buy it. It seems normal. And the fact that it's so outrageous, the fact that what he's talking about is so insane, but that it's all done with such normalcy, is why you suddenly start thinking, hey, this makes kind of sense.
Don't worry about the truth. I will put the words in your mouth. And I said, what is this, the burning bush? For God's sake, I'm not Moses. And the voice said to me, and I'm not God. What has that got to do with it? And the voice said to me, we're not talking about eternal truth or absolute truth or ultimate truth. We're talking about impermanent, transient human truth. I don't expect you people to be capable of truth, but God damn it, at least you're capable of...
Patty was a good friend of John Chancellor, who at that time was the anchorman at NBC. I was a very good friend of Walter Cronkite, who was at that time the anchorman at CBS. And one of the things that we knew from both of them, and he from John and I from Walter, was that these men were number one, they were reporters. They weren't pretty faces who'd been hired to repeat the news. They wrote their own material. And there was a thorough belief in it, which is why Walter became known as the man who all America trusted. And when he left that anchor desk, I think we all saw a shift in the way news was being presented.
I think you're having a breakdown. Require treatment.
This is not a psychotic episode. This is a cleansing moment of clarity.
I'm imbued, Max. I'm imbued with some special spirit. It's not a religious feeling at all. It's a shocking...
What Peter's doing now is so difficult. Playing a madman is one of the toughest things. It sounds easy. But to make you believe that he, the character, believes that is not easy. And Peter's doing it just wonderfully.
Birds. All the animals of the world. And even to some great, unseen, living force.
He just takes it so simply. You can do that because the words are so glorious. And then, of course, everybody's reactions. The fact that Jordan in the background there can't even look at him tells you something. And the look on Bill's face is so stunned. His old buddy that he was laughing with at the beginning of this movie.
I feel on the verge of something great, ultimate truth. And you will not take me off the air for now or for any other spaceless time.
The authenticity of everything, the size of the offices, the sloppiness of the offices. Notice, I wouldn't even let them clean up the carpet because carpets don't get swept up much. Or if they do, they're dirtied again right away. This whole next sequence was shot in one of the glorious New York apartment houses called the Apthorpe. It's on Broadway, running from 79th to 78th Street. And a wonderful old building. And this apartment is the apartment of Alfred Meisel, the great documentary maker. I knew any number of people. Tony Walton lives there. Nora Ephron used to live there. So I knew any number of people in the apartment. And I figured, well, that's where Bill Holden would be living. It's not one of the most expensive buildings in New York, but it is one of the grandest. And you start with the truth, which is, where would the Bill Holden character live? The Apthorpe is perfect. This is the bedroom. This is the hallway. It's our dressing. We emptied out all of Meisel's. Meisel lives much more simply. All of Meisel's furniture and brought our own in. We wanted it a little bit grander. Here you're looking at the glorious Beatrice Straight, one of the most beautiful actresses we've ever had, and also one of the best.
Because Howard's gone.
She has this scene and one other scene. This scene is not much. She has one more scene, which lasts about 5 minutes, and she took an Academy Award for that. It's a brilliantly written scene. The one coming up.
From Albuquerque to Sandusky, the response is sensational. Yes. All right. You, Herb. Get back to your office.
One of the wonderful things is that we, when you're working on location, when we shot this scene, as you can see, it was raining like mad outside, which meant that we had to, of course, match everything to it. So the previous shot in their kitchen, when Beatrice Straight went in there, we had to put rain on those windows, and coming up, we're going to have to put rain on Howard Beale as he's walking down the street.
Special spirits.
But it's again part of the joy of location. No way we could have faked this rain because we're up on about the 32nd floor.
profit, even a manufactured one, even if he's as mad as Moses. By tomorrow, he'll have a 50 share, maybe even a 60. Howard Beale is processed instant God, and right now, it looks like he may just go over bigger than Mary Tyler Moore.
I am not putting...
You never take those things personally. You don't think, oh, well, aren't we lucky or anything like that. You just trust that it's going to work out for the best, because if you planned it right, all the breaks go for you. If you haven't, they just don't. This is one of those fortuitous pictures where everything broke right.
This building by noon. I'll call the security guard and have you thrown out if you're still here.
And thank God the sun didn't come out while we were shooting.
If you want me out of here, you're going to have to drag me out kicking and screaming, and the whole news division kicking and screaming with me.
You think they're going to quit their jobs for you? Not in this recession, buddy.
When Ruddy gets back, he'll have your ass.
I got a hit, Schumacher, and Ruddy doesn't count anymore. He was hoping I'd fall on my face with his Beale show, but I didn't. It's a big, fat, big, titted hit, and I don't want to run Ruddy anymore.
I love Duval. He's got a kind of sincerity about him that makes the vulgarity twice as effective.
Standing up there at the annual CCA management review meeting, and I'm going to announce projected earnings for this network for the first time in 5 years. And believe me,
you'd never think of Duval on a part like this.
He's going to say, "That's very good, Frank. Keep it up." So don't have any illusions about who's running this network from now on. You're fired. I want you out of your office before noon, or I'll have you thrown out.
Wonderful actor. Wonderful actor.
You go along with this?
Max, I told you I didn't want a network hassle on this. I told you I'd much rather work the Beale show out just between the two of us.
I don't know what to say about actors reacting perfectly, because it's so much a part of the norm of what they're doing if they're working well.
We're going to spread this whole reeking business in every newspaper, on every network, group, and affiliate in this country. I'm going to make a lot of noise about this.
So many times on pictures, because they haven't rehearsed it, because they haven't worked it out cleanly and in advance.
Not anymore.
These things are mechanical and forced. But, not here. Not with these actors. This is rain that we provided, because we had to by then. It was shot on another day, but it had to match.
What do you do, Mr. Beale?
I must make my witness.
Sure thing, Mr. Beale. Oil ministers of the open...
One of the things that happened was... Patty, of course, knows so much more about comedy than I do. And on just that scene where you saw him coming through and the guard treated him absolutely normally.
Six, five, four, three, two, one.
When he first came in, I had the guard look at him strangely. And then when he said, "Sure thing, Mr. Beale," he looked at him as if, "My God, I'm dealing with a lunatic here." And Patty came rushing over to me and he said, "Sidney, no, no, no." It's as if it's absolute norm for him. He's not, this is television. Nutty people are a norm for him. And, of course, Patty was absolutely right.
Hey, crew, Q Howard.
I don't have to tell you things about...
And here, of course, is coming one of the famous scenes in movies, I must say. I'd never thought that it would achieve the kind of iconic significance it has. But... it sure has.
Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it.
There's a wonderful story about this scene. Most of the time, I'm not even aware of the number of takes I go, because I do so few. And we shot this. What you're looking at is take two. When we got to the second part of the scene, you will be looking at take one. Because Peter just did a brilliant job on take one. And I said to him, "Peter, it's just marvelous. Do one more, and let's just see, just for the sake of it." And he started again. Between the length of the speech and the amount of emotion it took...
You've got to say, "I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value."
And he just ran out of gas. He stopped halfway through. He said, Sidney, I can't do anymore.
I want all of you to get up.
I didn't know at the time that he was a sick man.
Get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out. And
a number, I think it was like 8 or 10 months later when we were out in Hollywood.
I want you to get up right now.
Getting ready for the Academy Award, Peter was sitting on a bench downstairs in the Beverly Hills Hotel, and as I came down the steps to join him, we were going to go to a radio broadcast together, he keeled over in a heart attack. And his inability to get through this a second time was the only indication I'd ever had of him not being in the best physical shape.
Anymore.
Who are you talking to, Herb? Are they yelling in Atlanta, Herb?
Are they yelling in Atlanta, Ted? But first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.
Like all of Patty's, I think almost on every Chayefsky picture, there's been a phrase or a line that's come out that's come into the culture. In Marty, it was... I don't know, Marty. What do you want to do tonight? And in this one, of course, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. It just has come into the language of America.
I'm not going to take it anymore! I'm mad as hell! I'm not going to take it anymore!
I'm mad as hell! I'm not
going to
take it anymore!
This whole sequence, this exterior, these exteriors of people shouting, we shot it in one night. One of the things that we that was very, very difficult on the pictures, we did not have a big budget. In fact, we had a very tight budget. All of the actors, I think Peter, Bill, Faye, all took less than their usual salaries because they loved their parts so. So this all had to be done in one night, and we just laid it out very carefully, lit it in advance, and it, needless to say, took us all night. But we got it. Just traveled around from location to location with our lightning machine, which is actually just a great big high-voltage set of rods that cause a great flash as they're brought close together.
In the Nielsen ratings, The Howard Beale Show was listed as the fourth highest rated show of the month, surpassed only by The $6 Million Man, All in the Family, and Phyllis.
One of the things I looked for, because I knew it would be so difficult to do this in one night, was I had to find a gigantic building that was totally unoccupied. I got one absolutely across the street from the MGM building where we were shooting the main offices. It was on 6th Avenue from 55th to 54th Street, totally abandoned, an old hotel, and we just sent the electricians in well in advance to light the specific windows I was going to shoot, and arrived, and off we went. The California sequence that you're seeing here, this office, also location. If you want California, what you need, of course, is highways. That's all California is highways and cars. And so out at exit 49 of the Long Island Expressway, I found four major highways coming together. You see the reflection of it now in that plaque behind the desk. And again, we got a lucky break because this building actually belongs to the Teamsters Union. And in movies, we use, especially on an all-location picture, we use a lot of Teamsters. So they were only too happy to give us the offices. For nothing, I might add. But there are the, there's the four-lane highway behind it, which, as you know, for California, is like a side street.
It's going to be a two-hour special on Marianne Gifford. Let me tell you what I want. I want a lot more film, like the bank rip-off the Ecumenical sent in. The way I see the series is, each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism taken on the spot in the actual moment. Then we go to the drama behind the opening film footage. That
Patty, of course, as I said, keeps making use of all of the news items about him. The instructions here, of course, for this hairdo was so typical of the Black Panther movement with the afro, and even the intonation where a kind of pattern gets into the speech that's so typical because people are just repeating things by rote.
We would not want to produce a television show celebrating historically deviational terrorism.
Miss Hobbs, I'm offering you an hour of primetime television every week.
And even here, the Dunaway character wins her over by being completely honest.
Whose leader is an eccentric, to say the least. He calls himself the great Ahmed Khan, and wears a hussar's shako.
Miss Hobbs, we're talking about 30 to 50 million people a shot. It's a lot better than handing out mimeograph pamphlets on ghetto street corners.
Well, I'll have to take this matter to the Central Committee. I'd better check it out with the great Ahmed Khan.
I'll be in LA until 7.
It still happens today, which is that as soon as people get around TV, they cannot resist it. One of the things that breaks my heart is how normal it has become for people to open their homes and their faces to the most intimate details just because a television camera is there. It breaks my heart. I wasn't home and my baby lit the matches and now my baby's gone. I mean, the amount of heartbreaking human revelation that goes on, and all with no intimacy whatsoever, sharing it with everybody, throwing it out there for everyone to see, because the 6 o'clock news is part of the reality of everybody's life.
What the fuck are you talking about?
30 seconds.
All right, ready, VTA. 1, you have the audience to pan.
25.
2, you have the window to pull. 3, you're on the announcer.
20.
And here, of course, comes the big show, the final step in converting news to entertainment, including it having a whole audience to watch it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
3, cue announcer. Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it. How do you feel? Ladies and gentlemen, the Network News Hour with Sybil the Soothsayer.
Sybil the Soothsayer. She's going to tell us the future.
Jim Webbing, and here's the Emma's Truth Department.
It's the Emma's Truth. Emma's is the Jewish word for telling the truth.
Miss Matahari and her skeletons in the closet.
Here's the gossip columnist. Now, by the way, notice that the stagehands are not in view on camera, but our camera sees them. They're the ones who are turning the platforms. The platforms aren't even mechanical, functioning on their own. The window behind him, of course, is totally fake.
Edward George Ruddy died today. Edward George Ruddy was the chairman of the board of the Union Broadcasting Systems, and he died at 11 o'clock this morning of a heart condition, and woe is us. We're in a lot of trouble. So, a rich little man with white hair died. What has that got to do with the price of rice, right? And why?
One of the things that Peter accomplished so brilliantly in this part is that he was able to incorporate what would have been Howard Beale's whole point of view into the character of a madman.
3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube.
As the piece goes on, he's more and more convinced of his own self-righteousness.
It didn't come out of this tube.
Which leaves him completely vulnerable for his final corruption, which we'll see in a moment, in a few minutes, in the scene with Ned Beatty. Great joy for me was staging this for the cameras. I'm talking about for the television cameras. So that no matter where I put my camera, my movie camera, they were always part of what was going on in the dramatic action of the scene. Including the fact that I actually had the control room, switching from camera to camera the way it does in a live show, so that the lights on top of the camera would come on when that camera was supposedly on the air.
Shit will be better for truth on this network. So you listen to me. Listen to me. Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Here, I think, in this speech of Peter's, I think probably comes as close to Patty's actual point of view and feeling as anything in the movie.
So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. But man, you're never going to get any truth from us. We'll tell you anything you want to hear. We lie like hell. We'll tell you that Kojak always gets the killer and that nobody ever gets cancer in Archie Bunker's house.
What's funny is that now even some of the television shows are repeating. I saw an advertisement that Kojak is now a new series with Bing Rames, and here it was a very successful series in the 70s.
Oh, sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know.
It was another advantage of doing the show in Canada because they still did a lot of live shows when we were shooting this movie, and so that the camera movements, the television camera movements, were totally legitimate, as if they were shooting a live show.
In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of the sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
And there, of course, one of the great television moments. The audience applauding, standing on their feet of their own, and somebody still running forward to urge them to applaud more. Network had to be flinched off. Please note an increase. This board meeting and the subsequent scene that's going to take place here between Ned Beatty and Peter Finch. Believe it or not, I found it in the boardroom of the New York Library on 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. It's an amazing room. We didn't change a thing in it.
Go beyond that. This network may well be the most significant profit center of the communications complex. And based upon the...
You get a better view of it in the next scene.
And if merger is eventually accomplished, the communications complex may well become the towering and most profitable...
Again, the way Patty introduces people is so marvelous. This whole dolly is to introduce... that character, Ned Beatty.
Mr. Jensen.
Very good, Frank. Exemplary. Keep it up.
With one line, bang, you're off. You've met him now. Here's one of my favorite scenes, because I live right around the corner. My call was later than anybody else's. Took me only 3 minutes to reach the set.
Do you have to get back to the office?
Nothing that can't wait.
A very difficult thing is, on location, you'll see how fiercely the wind is blowing. It's a very, very cold day, even though it was the beginning of spring.
I drop down to the news studios every now and then. And
if you haven't got a great audio man, a scene like this can... the wind can murder you.
Are you keeping busy?
The audio man was Jimmy Sabat, with whom I'd done a lot of movies. And he was able to place the mic so that we got all voice and almost no wind. And so we didn't have to loop any of it.
Dying and having grandchildren.
You should be a grandfather yourself about now. You have a pregnant daughter in Seattle, don't you?
Any day now. My wife's out there for the occasion.
Looping always has a mechanical quality about it to me. I can always spot it. I think it's not the best thing in the world for performance. There are some actors who are brilliant loopers. Most of the European actors, the continental European, French, Italian, German, are great loopers because they don't shoot with the sound they use only as a guide track, the dialogue on the set. They are used to doing it all in the looping room. But for American actors, I think we do a much better job on it, fighting to get good sound on location.
Don't worry, you will. It was a many splendid night, wasn't it, Max?
Yes, it was.
Are we going to get involved, Max?
Yes. I need to become involved very much. How about you?
I've reached for the phone to call you 100 times, but I was sure you hated me for my part in taking your new show away.
I probably did.
There's a reason that location shooting began to mean so much in movies. It obviously, right after the war, the Italians just started creating a series of brilliant movies. All done on location. They had no studios. They had no choice. There were no studios. They couldn't afford the electricity even. It was a very poor country. But it started contributing something to movies that was irreplaceable. And of course we all picked up on it and began doing our movies on location as well.
NBC is offering 3.2.5 mil per package of 5 James Bond movies, and I think I'm going to steal them for 3.5 for the third run.
Another step toward total romance and seduction, talking about nothing but movies. I mean, nothing but television and or movies. This is shot in East Hampton, again, not far from my house, so I was rather glad to be able to get locations close by. Always a pleasure. And here she goes again, talking about work in the most romantic of circumstances. And it climaxes with the total seduction and work combining. She finally has an orgasm talking about work.
No, but we're getting around the FBI by...
We are by now even up to wood-burning fireplaces, which is about as cornerly romantic as you can get in movies. Sea Spray Rin, actually, it was a wonderful spot. It burned down the following year. So this is the last recorded film of it. This is actually one of their rooms.
But it's an absolute mix on going to series. They'll hit us with conspiracy and inducement to commit a crime. Christ, it's cold in here. See, we're paying these nuts from the Yankee Medical Liberation Army $10,000 a week in order to turn in...
But so wonderful is her delight in what she's talking about as she's undressing.
Inducement to commit a crime. And Walter says we'll all wind up in federal prison. I said, Walden, let the government sue us. Let the federal government sue us. We'll take them to the Supreme Court. We'll be front page. The New York Times. The Washington Post. The editorial that was us. We'll be front page for months. We'll have more press than one.
And here, you'll pardon the expression, is the climax of all of her romanticism, love, and her work.
American start carrying his own time slot.
What I found wonderful also in the shooting of this was not only Faye's lack of inhibition in doing it, but how brave Bill was, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to be one of the biggest stars and let the other person have all of the fun, the whole speech, and you have to lie there faking that you're pumping into her and not allowed any reaction that's going to interfere with the comedy. Noble of him. A noble man.
Talk about a woman hopelessly in love with her husband's mistress. What do you think?
Here comes the scene that Beatrice won the Academy Award for, and well-deserved.
How long has it been going on?
A month. I thought it was a transient thing, blow over in a week. I still pray to God it's just a menopausal infatuation. But it is an infatuation, Louise.
One of the lovely things about the Apthorpe is that it has an inner courtyard so that you've got the benefit of windows and real daylight coming in. But also no trucks, no buses. You've got perfect sound. And I love what Bill does here. It's so simple, unforced, and nothing fake. Nothing fake.
I know I'm obsessed with her.
Say it. Don't keep telling me that you're obsessed, that you're infatuated. Say that you're in love with her.
I'm in love with her.
Beatrice and I had a long history together. We had, from live television, and one of the best shows I think that I ever did in live television, we did Antigone, and Beatrice played Antigone, and brilliantly. She's just a major actor. Extraordinary training, technique.
Secretary, is it, or some broad that you picked up after three belts of booze. This is your great winter romance, isn't it? Your last roar of passion before you settle into your emeritus years. Is that what's left for me? Is that my share? She gets the winter passion and I get the dotage? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to sit home knitting and purling while you slink back like some penitent drunk? I'm your wife, dammit!
She is also, as you can see, an incredible beauty. And something rare for actors. She comes from a grand old American family. A woman of means and rich education, rich background, schools, and one of the few in that class who ever got herself involved with acting.
Oh, say something for God's sake.
I've got nothing to say.
I won't give you up easily, Max.
She's something.
I think perhaps it is better if you move out.
Coming up is one of my favorite lines. And it's again the truth of what Patty feels. Well, the truth of what Patty feels permeates every page of this.
I'm not sure she's capable of that.
Here he comes.
She's television generation. She learned life from Bugs Bunny.
She loved life from Bugs Bunny. That's, it's absolutely accurate because so much of what we're dealing with today comes because people, we're now in probably, the third generation of people who've never known life without television.
Here we are going
and so much of what they're thinking and feeling today is vicarious. It's learned from the box, but they've never experienced it actually. And I think it's got a lot to do with the state of things today.
Of the happy American family. She does have one script in which I kill myself. An adapted for television version of Anna Karenina, where she's Count Vronsky and I'm Anna.
That always made me laugh more than any other line in the movie.
You're in for some dreadful grief, Max.
I know.
How tender the people are with each other. You see, as rough as the subject matter is, and the irony, and the satire, all in all, there is such tenderness in this movie. Here, of course, is one of my favorite scenes, which is the prime revolutionaries sitting with four William Morris agents negotiating their television contract.
Proceeds should consist of all funds the sublicensee receives, not merely the net amount remitted after payment to the sublicensee or distributor.
We're not sitting.
Lance Hendrickson there. All of this, the.
Fuck with my distribution card.
All of this, of course, being the real language of contracts. Patty was using actual contractual language.
No shit with me about a piece again. I'm paying Metro 20% for all foreign and Canadian distribution, and that's after a government. The Communist Party's not going to see a nickel out of this goddamn show until we go into syndication.
Oh, come on, Rudy. The party's $7,500
a week production expense. I'm not giving this pseudo-insurrectionary sectarian a piece of my show.
Wonderful, wonderful scene.
My distribution charges. You fucking fascist! Did you see the film we made of San Reno jailbreak out demonstrating the rising up of the Seminole prisoner class infrastructure?
You can blow the Seminole prisoner class infrastructure out your ass! I'm not knocking down my goddamn distribution charges!
I'm sorry to keep laughing, but I still find it funny today. The Patty Hearst character is actually played by Walter Cronkite's daughter. And a lovely girl who, I don't know whether she gave up acting or what, but she had a great deal of talent.
As used herein, subsidiary rights means, without limitation, any and all rights.
I don't know what Patty's, what the limits were, if any, of Patty's imagination of combining these fantastical characters with what, with totally realistic contexts, like using the real language of a television contract with Ahmed Khan and his group and these William Morris agents. This we shot in the ballroom, main ballroom of the Plaza Hotel.
You all know that she is the woman behind the Howard Beale Show. We all know she's beautiful. We all know she's brainy. I was thinking, before we start digging into our Chateaubriands, let's show her how we feel about her.
Not a bad looking lady.
The top five. Last year we were the number four network. Next year we're number one.
The scene took one morning to shoot, half a day. If you lay out the lighting in advance, you should be able to cover a lot of material in an easy amount of time.
7 o'clock here in Los Angeles, and right now over a million homes using television in this city are turning their dials to channel 3, and that's our channel.
That's a great part of Patty's own design, of course, that it's so close to politics. And here we go into a scene which could have been shot yesterday.
They simply buy up a controlling share of the stock, but first they have to file notice with the government. That's how CCA...
I mean, that's how amazingly attuned Patty was to the basic way we're living.
Funding Corporation, they filed the notice this morning. Well, just who in the hell is the Western World Funding Corporation? It is a consortium of banks and insurance companies who are not buying CCA for themselves, but as agents for somebody else. And who is the somebody else? They won't tell you. They won't tell you. They won't tell the Senate. They won't tell the SEC, the FTC. They won't tell the Justice Department. They won't
tell Mr. Hackett, do you have a New York call for me?
The hell it is!
Do you want to turn that down, please?
I will tell you who they're buying CCA for.
There's a scene coming up that becomes really, in a way, one of the most frightening things, because it's so totally, so fantastic. I mean that fantastic in the sense of, oh, who could believe this? It's not even shot realistically. And yet it is exactly the way we live today. I'll comment on it when we hit the scene.
The Howard Beale show's just going on out here. You guys get it 3 hours earlier in New York. Clarence, take it easy. How the hell could I see it? It's just going on now.
On Duval's right hand is something that was in great fashion then. Everybody had tennis elbow and tennis wrist from spending too much time on the tennis courts. And a copper bracelet was supposed to help you through that.
Downtown pieces of Boston, a part of the port of New Orleans, an industrial park in Salt Lake City. They own big hunks of the Atlanta Hilton, the Arizona Land and Cattle Company. Part of a bank in California, the Bank of the Commonwealth in Detroit. They control Aramco, so that puts them into Exxon, Texaco, and Mobil Oil. They're all over. New Jersey, Louisville, St. Louis, Missouri. And that's only what we know about. There's a hell of a lot more we don't know about, because all of those Arab petrodollars are washed through Switzerland and Canada and the biggest banks in this country. For example, what we don't know about is this CCA deal.
In this scene, really, he's everything that Patty picked as an example of what was being bought up in America was absolutely true. He didn't invent any of it. All of it was factual.
U.S. Steel and 20 other American companies. Hell, they already own half of England. So listen to me. Listen to me, goddammit. The Arabs are simply buying us. There's only one thing that can stop them. You. So, I want you to get up now. I want you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the phone. I want you to get up from your chairs, go to the phone, get in your cars, drive into the Western Union offices in town. I want you to send a telegram to the White House.
Oh my God.
By midnight tonight, I want a million telegrams in the White House. I want them wading knee-deep in telegrams in the White House. I want you to get up right now and write a telegram to President Ford saying...
I think that one of the most trenchant things in the whole scene that applies so much today is how much control was being wrested out of our hands in terms of the destiny of the country by foreign ownership. It may not be only oil today, or just oil, because that's what that is what's being used today, was being used then and being used today. But as you know, so much of what we've got in the so much of the economy of the country is totally dependent. Continual purchase and ownership of United States Treasury bonds by foreign countries. And one of the enormous dangers today of the falling dollar is that at one point they may say, wait a minute, these bonds may not, and the debt we've been accumulating, these bonds may lose a lot of their value. And if they ever stop buying them or start throwing them onto the open markets, so that the value of the bonds will drop, it might precipitate one of the greatest financial crises this country has ever had. But primarily, it's the loss of control we've got over our own destiny, really. And that's what was concerning Patty enormously 30 years ago.
An hour ago, Clarence McElhaney called me from New York. It was 10 o'clock in the east. And our people in the White House report they were already knee-deep in telegrams. By tomorrow morning, we'll be sucked in telegrams.
And the government stopped the deal?
They can hold it up. The SEC could hold this deal up for 20 years if they wanted to. I'm finished. Any second that phone's going to ring and Clarence McElhaney's going to tell me Mr. Jensen wants me in his office tomorrow morning so he can personally chop my head off. 4 hours ago, I was a sun god at CCA. Mr. Jensen's hand...
Bob's performance here. I think this was take one.
Now? I'm a man without a corporation.
I never knew that he had that kind of humor in his acting.
You're not seriously going to pull Bill off the air.
Jensen's unhappy with Howard Beale and wants him discontinued.
But he may be unhappy.
We had worked together once in live television, not extensively, once.
$2 billion isn't peak!
I sure knew how good he was.
God wants Howard Beale fired!
What for? Every other network will grab him the minute he walks out the door. He'll be back on the air for ABC tomorrow and we'll lose 20
I'm
points.
I'm going to pay the son of a bitch with a sharp stick through the heart!
$40 million loss in revenues for the year.
I got a contract.
Let's not discount federal action by the Justice Department. If CCA...
No, I'll do it myself.
Off the air as an act of retribution.
I think one of the things that the actors were able to, in live television, were able to assimilate as part of their technique was the same thing that the theater gives you, which is the necessity of making the dramatic selection in advance. You don't get a chance to work in the detail that you do in movies, shot by shot. But you sure have a much better idea and sense of control over the entire arc of the character. And that is irreplaceable because that teaches you to use whatever you need sparingly and not to repeat anything.
Mr. Jensen wants to meet Howard Beale personally. He wants Mr. Beale in his office at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
This is again shot on the main staircase of the New York Public Library.
The final revelation is at hand. I have seen the shattering fulgurations of ultimate clarity. The light is impending. I bear witness to the light.
And here comes Ned Beatty looking like... We tried to get him to look just like Teddy Roosevelt, who was the beginning of this kind of a character.
Only desultorily.
How are you now?
I'm as mad as a hatter.
Who is it?
American Destiny was the key of that character. He started as a salesman.
Sewing machines and automobile parts. Hairbrushes and
now he's going to convince him that we have to own the world.
I'd like to try to sell something to you.
Including the necessity of making the whole thing a performance. He's going to seat him down. He's going to darken the room. He's going to arrange the light to the most strongest dramatic effect. Including a spotlight on himself.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it! Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case.
This is the scene I was talking about before, where Paddy lays out his primary belief, which I think has turned out to be absolutely true.
Man who thinks in terms of nations and people.
Here it comes.
There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars...
And you have to keep in mind that when Paddy wrote this, we had the great single enemy of the United States. Russia, as a communist state, not only still existed then, was, we thought... at its height. And China had gone communist by then.
That is the natural order.
And here is Paddy having this character say...
is the atomic and subatomic...
that there is none of that matters.
...structure of things today.
That all there is one big corporation.
The primal forces of from nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl.
Marvelously easy to shoot because, funnily enough, you get the scene clearly had to be treated unrealistically. We are now very far from the beginning of the movie.
And DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide.
Here we go.
And Exxon. Those are the nations of the world.
Those are the nations of the world.
What do you think the Russians talk about in their councils of state?
Here we go.
They get out their linear programming charts, statistical decision theories, min-max solutions, and compute the price-cost probabilities of their transactions and investments, just like we do. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale.
The essence of what he's saying, here it comes.
College of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
And it's out of that that I was talking about Teddy Roosevelt, because basically that was his approach to the American century.
Our children will live, Mr. Beale, to see that...
The choice of the room, as you can see, was perfect for the scene because it allowed you to get into a completely unreal extension without it ever showing.
Oppression or brutality.
And what happens, of course, is that Howard Beale becomes absolutely convinced because the guy is making perfect sense to him.
And will hold a share of stock. All necessities provided. All anxieties tranquilized. All boredom amused.
We had another actor doing it. And, during rehearsal, he made the fatal mistake of playing the madness, and I couldn't break him away from it.
Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel.
Why me?
Because you're on television, dummy.
So we had to let him go. We cast Ned literally 3 days before the scene was scheduled to be shot.
You just might be right.
He flew in from California, knew his lines perfectly, gave this astonishing performance.
Cosmology of Arthur Jensen.
Last night, I got up here and asked you people to stand up and fight for your heritage, and you did, and it was beautiful. 6 million telegrams were received at the White House.
One of the interesting things, too, is how
the people spoke, the people won.
Honest all of the characters are. He is about, Howard Beale here, is about to reverse his entire point of view. Everything he said before, he's going to throw out now.
Because at the bottom of all our terrified souls, we know that democracy is a dying giant, a sick, sick, dying...
And he doesn't deny what he says. He's absolutely honest in telling them what changed him.
...finished as a world power. The United States is the richest, the most powerful, the most advanced country in the world, light years ahead of any other country. And I don't mean the communists are going to take over the world, because the communists are deader than we are. What is finished is the idea that this great country is dedicated to the freedom and flourishing of every individual in it. It's the individual that's finished. It's the single, solitary human...
What's interesting, too, is I think if you ever put up the way this scene was shot, as opposed to the way the first scene of the Howard Beale show was shot, you'd see a tremendous difference. This is shot much more simply, far less intercutting, because we're getting down to it now. Patty isn't kidding anymore, and in a peculiar way... The time for laughter is almost past. We're in the scene that we just left, the scene with Ned Beatty. The last joke in the script, because you're on television, dummy, has happened. There'll be other funny lines. But basically, from here on in, Patty wants to get down to what he wants out of the whole picture.
It looks human, but art. The whole world, not just us, we're just the most advanced country, so we're getting there first. The whole world's people are becoming mass-produced, programmed, numbered, insensate things.
It was a perfectly admissible argument that Howard Beale advanced in the days...
Here, he is getting down to what Patty really believes has happened to America, which is that we're being told that we're the same as automobile tires, that that's what we've let ourselves become.
First time since last November.
You're his goddamn agent, Lou. I'm counting on you to talk some sense into the lunatic. Nobody wants to hear about dying democracy and dehumanization.
I'm sorry I'm late.
Look, we're starting to get rumbles from the agencies. Another couple of weeks of this and the sponsors will be bailing out. This is a breach of contract, Lou.
This is the Howard Beale we signed. You better get him off that corporate universe, kick, or so help me, I'll pull him off the air.
I told him, Lou. I've been telling him every day for a week. I'm sick of telling him. Now you tell him.
Just like sex was at its most glorious when the news was good, now the news is turning bad, and so life is going to start to turn bad between them.
Oh, if you wanted to, he listens to you. You're his best friend.
I'm tired of all this hysteria about Howard Beale.
Every time you come back from seeing somebody in your family, you come back in one of these morbid, middle-aged moods.
And I'm tired of finding you on the goddamn telephone every time I turn around. I'm tired of being an accessory in your life.
All of the honest things that happen between people, and Patty uses them constantly. He also uses the Bill Holden character as the one voice of sanity throughout the entire picture.
Early years of television. And nobody wants a dumb, damn, goddamn book about...
Not a bad kick for a 60-year-old guy.
Maybe you could start a whole new career as an actor!
It's the truth. After living with you for 6 months... I'm turning into one of your scripts.
And here's Bill at his best.
Well, this is not a script, Diana. There's some real, actual life going on here. I went to visit my wife today because she's in a state of depression. So depressed that my daughter flew all the way from Seattle to be with her. And I feel lousy about that. I feel lousy about the pain that I've caused my wife and my kids. I feel guilty and conscience-stricken. And all of those things that you think sentimental... but which my generation calls simple human decency. And I miss my home. Because I'm beginning to get scared.
Here's one of the most honest moments.
This is the beginning, and death is suddenly a perceptible thing.
That Bill's, I think, ever had in a performance. And it's one of the incredible advantages of rehearsal.
You're dealing with a man... that has primal doubts, Diana.
Because I noticed when we were rehearsing that he would look everywhere but at Faye when he was rehearsing it. And part of I sort of divined the reason for it. I felt that he felt so close to the truth of what Patty was saying here that he almost didn't dare look at her. And so I stopped rehearsing the scene.
You can't switch to another station.
And on the day we shot it, I said, Bill, I want you to do just one thing. Latch onto her eyes and don't ever look away from her. And this world of emotion came pouring out. This is all take one.
I just want you to love me, primal doubts and all.
And for Faye, of course, I gave her the same direction. Don't take your eyes away from him, but just try to understand what he's talking about. She doesn't know what he's talking about. So just try to get it. And thank God the phone rings just in time.
I'll be with you in a minute now.
Having told her at the beginning there was no vulnerability, that's as close a moment as she gets, because she's hearing something that she's never heard before.
The show was down 11 points. Hysteria swept through the network.
He's smallpox. He's tight boys. I don't want to follow his goddamn show. I want not to have it at
a
spot.
I love that. Now she wants another lead-in for her show. Those were all real shows that were on the air at the time.
Get him off! Do something! Do anything!
We're trying to find a replacement for him. I'm going down to look at audition footage right now.
And how
Melvin, the sixth seal.
I'd always wanted to shoot at this location. You can't see it well in the shot because it's so far away, but that is actually, believe it or not, a rock in Central Park that sticks out over the highway. So the cops were good enough to stop the traffic for us while we shot it.
Damn it! We wanted hellfire, we get Billy Graham, we don't want...
It looks like it's, of course, the wilderness. I'd have no idea who the actor is. I've forgotten his name, but he was wonderful.
His ass ending.
Jesus, turn him off!
I'm talking about...
I've got three more, but you've already seen the best one. I've got a guru from Spokane and two more hellfires who see visions of the Virgin Mary.
We're not going to find a replacement for Howard Beale, so let's stop kidding us.
We're, of course, leading to something, which is the climax of the movie. And not able to really find a replacement for him. So how to go out? How to resolve the Howard Beale story?
It would be disaster to let this situation go on another week. By then he'll be dead.
In which we do move to fantasy, but only in the sense that it simply hasn't happened yet. But it will.
I think we should fire...
I'm talking about the end of the movie. I don't want to anticipate it for you.
Arthur Jensen has taken a strong personal interest in the Howard Beale show.
I'm having dinner with him tonight. Let me have another crack at Jensen, and then let's meet in my office at 10 o'clock tonight. Diana, give me copies of all your audience research reports. I may need them for Jensen. Is 10 o'clock convenient for everyone?
All of the people in here really feel deeply about what they're saying, whether it's the Dunaway character, the Duval character. They all mean it. And you can see the lighting just getting more and more conventional in terms of the romantic look.
Time has come to reevaluate our relationship, Max.
I love that she's packed his bag for him. She hasn't let him make the decision.
It's turning into a seedy little drama. Middle-aged man leaves wife and family. The young, heartless woman goes to pot.
She's checking to make sure that she didn't leave anything out.
I don't like it.
So you're going to cancel the show?
Yeah, right.
Let me do that.
But the simple fact is, Max, that you're a family man. You like a home and kids, and that's beautiful, but I am incapable of any such commitment. All you'll get from me is another couple of months of intermittent sex and recriminate and ugly little scenes like the one we had last night. I'm sorry for all those things I said to you last night. You're not the worst fuck I've ever had. Believe me, I've had worse. You don't cough or snorkel and make death-like rattles. As a matter of fact, you're rather serene in the sack.
Why is it that a woman always thinks that the most savage thing she can say to a man is to impugn his coxmanship?
But I'm sorry I impugned your coxmanship.
I gave up comparing genitals back in the schoolyard.
This was a little duplex that we found in a hotel on Madison Avenue, which is just where she would live, of course.
I know it was over with us weeks ago.
Will you go back to your wife?
What I love about the way Bill plays the scene is that the regret is over, in a way.
I'm more concerned about you.
There, that's the key of it. He's really worried about what's going to happen with her.
Two before you crack up or jump out of your 14th floor office window.
Stop selling, Max. I don't need you. Your pain. I don't want your menopausal decay and death. I don't need you, Mark.
You
get out of
me. You need me badly.
The difference in training or difference in acting styles never matters if both actors are working honestly, which they both were.
You live the rest of the day.
Then don't leave me.
It's too late, Diana.
There's nothing left in you that I can live with.
Patty again gives everyone their own justification.
If I stay with you, I'll be destroyed. Like Howard Beale was destroyed. Like Lorraine Hobbs was destroyed. Like everything that you and the institution of television touch is destroyed.
Wow, no small thing for Patty to be saying.
Your television incarnate, Diana.
Indifferent to suffering. Insensitive to joy.
I loved working with Patty every second. I wanted him on the set. He was there in the cutting room. He's a great artist, and that's never going to be a problem. I have no pride of authorship. I don't want to have to think of it. If he thinks of it, great. If I think of it, great. It doesn't matter. Just the result matters.
A corrupt comedy. You even shatter the sense.
He, for his part, and I was very touched by this, said it was the best working time he'd ever had on anything, theater or movie.
Madness, Diana. Virulent madness.
I love what Faye did here, that he's calling her, he's telling her that she's crazy. Virulent madness. And in her reaction, she looks absolutely mad. That's, again, the kind of honesty of good acting.
And it's a happy ending.
Wayward husband comes to his senses, returns to his wife, with whom he's established a long...
The only point where Faye almost played the vulnerability. I know 20 actresses who would have been letting the tears stream down their faces at that point. She was fighting it every second.
Final commercial. Here are a few scenes from next week's show.
Again, Patty using the actual text of television shows. And now again, you can see the lighting and how far this has moved. Here's the penultimate scene. There's one scene later on that's going to intercut with this. But as they take their places here, this is what I meant when I said, by now... The picture just looks like a Ford commercial. It is so meticulously lit, so dramatically lit. And we got here, hopefully, without you noticing it. I mean, I asked you to notice it. I asked you to look at it. But if you had just seen the picture without any of my commentary, I don't think you would have been aware of it.
So he wants Howard Beale on the air, and he wants him kept on.
And I thought also the brilliance of the set decoration with the paintings that were on the wall, in which it would have been every painting that was expensive and chic, but representing absolutely nobody's taste.
Sinister silkiness. That volatility in business usually reflected bad management.
A perfectly clear desk.
They didn't care if Howard Beale was the number one show on television or the 50th. They didn't really care if the Beale...
Because they teach you at... Harvard Business School, a messy desk is a sign of inefficiency.
I would describe his position on this as inflexible.
The art director on the movie was Phil Rosenberg, with whom I had done many, many pictures.
That puts us in the shit house. That's where that puts us. Do you want me to go through this?
Yes.
Okay, the Beale Show Q score...
From the time we... got into the scene with Ned Beatty in that room. What Patty is writing, the way Patty is treating the script now is completely outside of realism. However, never confuse the outside of realism, things being unrealistic with them being untrue. The truth is greater than ever.
I have all developed their own audiences. Our AR reports show that it is Howard Beale that is the destructive force here. Minimally, we're talking about a 10-point differential in shares. I think Joe ought to spell it out for us, Joe.
28 shares, $80,000 minutes.
This scene is treated as a completely normal discussion of what's wrong with this program and how are we going to fix it. There's no passion in it. There's no humanity in it. They're just dealing with a problem.
You guys want to hear all the flack I'm getting from the affiliates?
We know all about it, Herb.
You would describe Mr. Jensen's position on Beale as inflexible?
Intractable and adamantine.
Another of my favorite lines.
So what do we do about this Beale son of a bitch?
Suppose we'll have to kill him. I don't suppose you have any...
You'll notice, by the way, that there is no music in the picture. I didn't think a score could add anything, and if anything, might kill some of the comedy. And especially because if you wrote a score, the composer would want desperately to, when he said, I guess we'll have to kill him, to put in a great big musical crash there. And that's exactly what we don't want, which is that we want everything handled as if it's normal, as if it's ordinary.
It could be done right on camera, in the studio. We ought to get a fantastic look-in audience for the assassination of Howard Beale as our...
I did not have to make a big deal about it because I have a final cut on a picture. And so there was no argument in it. I just wanted Patty to... of course, they wanted me to have it, and they were a little nervous at my not having it, but I think everybody saw the wisdom of it later. The main person I was concerned about, of course, the main person I wanted to please beside myself was Patty. And Patty saw the point of it right away, as most writers will, because most good writers, and especially comedy writers, which Patty also was, don't want anything interfering with their words anyhow.
Talking about a capital crime here. The network can't be implicated.
Patty prided himself on the fact that people were intelligent enough to get what he was talking about. They didn't have to have it explained to them by a score telling them what to feel, a musical score.
Well, the issue is, shall we kill Howard Beale or not? I'd like to hear some more opinions on that.
I don't see we have any option, Frank. Let's kill the son of a bitch.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it. How do you feel?
We're right now. We're not going to take this anymore.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Network News Hour with Sybil the Soothsayer.
You see, the whole message of the movie has changed, of the television show has changed by now. He's been delivering a very depressing message for the last months that he's been on the air. So they've lost a little of their pizzazz. Things aren't as gay as they had started out to be.
Howard Beale!
And that's about the only thing that hasn't happened in television yet. When Patty writes, he uses all things that have actually happened in television. And this was the only thing that has not happened yet. But I think it's still to come. I wouldn't be surprised to see it. On one of the reality shows, it'll happen. There'll be a real death. And it'll be shown to you, I promise you.
Don't you know this great big land has done so much for you? Mother country has got her arms open wide.
The extraordinary incident occurred in full view of its millions of viewers. The assassins were members of a terrorist group called the Ecumenical Liberation Army, two of whom were apprehended. The leader of the group, known as the Great Ahmed Khan, escaped.
This was the story of Howard Beale, the first known instance of a man who was killed because he had lousy ratings.
Like at least
Great Ahmed Khan in Pennsylvania.
Great Ahmed Khan,
a massive man, well-reported claim, carrying an automatic weapon,
and the
audience.
Meanwhile, the killer is still in the
Police spokesman says the
police
Network.